The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group, in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Mark Davis, in this week for Hugh Hewitt. Today, on the Town Hall Review, we continue to examine what happened in the high school in Florida.
Which do you think failed us more in these 17 deaths? Authorities or gun laws?
We'll hear from the sheriff who is now under fire.
My name is Scott Israel. I'm the Democrat. I'm a proud member of Team Obama.
Andrew McCarthy joins us for a look at foreign affairs.
Russia has been meddling in American elections forever.
And an upcoming Supreme Court decision has Democrats in a panic.
If this decision goes the way that I think it should, it will send shockwaves through California. It really is the Achilles tendon of the California Democratic Party.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Davis from 660 AM The Answer in Dallas-Fort Worth. In the aftermath of the school shooting in Parkland, Florida, this much has become clear. It should never have happened. And when it started, it should have been stopped sooner than it was. The failure on the part of the Broward County Sheriff's Office was years in the making, and it seems pretty clear the man in charge, Sheriff Scott Israel, was the wrong leader at a time when leadership was badly needed. Here's Salem host Michael Medved.
Here was a report on CNN about what Coral Springs officers reported about seeing the Broward County deputies cowering behind their vehicles. Listen.
Coral Springs police sources tell CNN that three other Broward County sheriff's deputies also remained outside, pistols drawn, but hiding behind their vehicles. It's unclear if the shooter was still there when they arrived, but not one of them had gone into the school. It was the Coral Springs officers who were the first to go in.
Okay, that's shocking. And that's appalling. There's no question at all that the officer Peterson, Deputy Peterson, was right to resign. Because for him to acknowledge that he had the opportunity to go in, but he didn't. He didn't risk his life. He didn't sacrifice his life. But that's his job. That's what he is supposed to do. So what went wrong here? Exactly. A lot of it goes to the head guy in the Broward County Sheriff's Department. He's been in the news a lot. He's become sort of a familiar public figure because he seems to have initially, at least, relished the publicity. His name is Scott Israel. And now there are protests calling for his resignation. This report from NBC News in Miami.
When officers from local police departments ran inside Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, our sources say three Broward sheriff's deputies remained outside of the freshman building where most of the shooting took place, and it's not clear why.
He's the boss. He's where the buck stops. He has to take responsibility.
The new revelation leading to protests this Saturday. Concerned parents calling for Broward County Sheriff Scott Israel's resignation.
I'm not, against BSO. I'm against Israel.
BSO detectives say they are investigating the claim from the Coral Springs Police Department that some deputies did not go into the school when they should have, and that this is not a fact.
Okay, all weekend long, the hashtag resign Sheriff Israel was trending, and it should be. When you find out about Scott Israel, he is not your typical tough cop, despite the fact that he tried to defend himself with Jake Tapper. Now, Jake Tapper is CNN, right? But he was very, very tough on this Democrat. And by the way, Scott Israel won election as the sheriff in Broward County as a proud Obama Democrat, he said. In fact, this excerpt from a 2012 Scott Israel campaign video, that was when he was first elected as the sheriff of Broward County. Listen to the way he talks about how he'll accept responsibility for any mistakes.
When we make mistakes, yes. But there'll be mistakes of the head, not the mistakes of the heart, not mistakes about character. And these mistakes, when we make them, we'll look into the camera, explain why we did it, and go in a different direction and learn from our mistakes. My name is Scott Israel. I'm the Democrat. I'm a proud member of Team Obama, and I'm asking that this county vote Democrat all the way down. Vote Scott Israel. Let's get the Republican out, and let's make a change. Thank you very much.
Okay, what he was doing was he was running against a Republican he had lost to 4 years before, who had been the incumbent as sheriff of Broward County, and he won that election. And then he won re-election. He won re-election by more than 2-1. He had only token opposition, a former sergeant from the sheriff's department who had run against his former boss. And despite the fact that he won big time, this was not the kind of tough law enforcement official that most American counties would elect. For instance, he, according to every report, and there's a lot of writing about this right now, he changed the police culture. For instance, appearing in 2015 at this police grocery giveaway. Listen.
I want the community to understand we're not a law enforcement agency that goes out and arrests people. Now, we do arrest violent offenders. There's no doubt about that. But more importantly, it's the compassion and trust we're trying to develop with the community so we don't have Ferguson's and we don't have South Carolina's. We want a community to trust in us. So I've decided we're not a policing agency. We're part of the community.
We're not a policing agency? I mean, this is appalling. This is appalling. How can you say that? How can you have? Of course, Scott Israel should resign. And listen to the way he handled his interchange on CNN with Jake Tapper, who asked him some pretty good questions. Remember, he said in his campaign video from 2012, if we make mistakes, we'll acknowledge them and we'll turn around. Listen to this.
Are you really not taking any responsibility for the multiple red flags that were brought to the attention of the Broward Sheriff's Office about this shooter before the incident, whether it was people near him, close to him, calling the police on him?
Jake, I could only take responsibility for what I knew about. I exercise my due diligence. I've given amazing leadership to this agency.
Amazing leadership?
Yes, Jake. There's a lot of things we've done throughout this. You don't measure a person's leadership by a deputy not going into a. These deputies received the training they needed.
Maybe you measure somebody's leadership by whether or not they protect the community. In this case, you've listed 23 incidents before the shooting involving the shooter, and still, nothing was done to keep guns out of his hands, to make sure that the school was protected, to make sure you were keeping an eye on him. Your deputy at the school failed. I don't understand how you can sit there and claim amazing leadership.
Okay, that's tough questioning from Jake Tapper. Appropriate? Anybody think it's not appropriate? On a Channel 7 news report in Miami, there was a student at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. His name was Brandon, who described what he saw, and what he saw particularly regarding Deputy Scott Peterson. Listen.
Source officer was behind a stairwell wall, just standing there, and he had his gun drawn, and he was just pointing it at the building. And shots started going off inside. You could hear them going off over and over again.
Brandon says Coach Aaron Feist risked his life and ran inside to help, but he says Officer Peterson didn't move.
He was pointing his gun at nothing. He was pointing his gun at just a building with kids in it. And he was just talking on the radio, and he never did anything for 4 minutes. He's the only one with a gun. He's wearing a bulletproof vest, and all, you know, he has all that while school security guards, you know, coaches pretty much, were running in, shielding kids. Coach Feist, Hickson, were running in, shielding kids from bullets and losing their lives while he did nothing.
If Brandon could say something to Peterson, this is what he would want to tell him.
You're despicable. You know, you didn't do your job. You were trained for this. You were armed. You had a bulletproof vest. You were protected more than anybody else who died, who lost their lives. And you did nothing. You froze. You got scared. You know, you did nothing at all. And you could have saved a lot of lives.
The Democrat response to the shooting? Nothing short of shameful. Instead of mourning the loss of life, they immediately went after the NRA. Instead of waiting to see what actually happened, what actually explained this horror, They went after gun laws. Instead of prayer, in fact, mocking prayer, they demanded legislation that would have stopped nothing. In hindsight, their actions look even more absurd. As more details emerge of what turned out to be a horrific dereliction of duty by so many in the world of law enforcement, one might expect some pullback. But that has not happened. Instead, many Democrats and most in the media have doubled down on their vitriol against the NRA and gun rights in general. Some are calling for the majority of guns to be outlawed. Salem host Dennis Prager examines this mindset.
I don't know any law that would have prevented this shooting. One of the ways to prevent them is for people to take seriously, if you see something, say something. In the case of the shooter, of the murderer in Parkland, Florida, so much was seen and so much was said that it gives lie to that saying. He called in. The murderer called in about himself, that he had lost it after his mother's death. His father had already died years earlier. Forget blame. Forget blame right now. What are people supposed to do if they all did it? People said he will shoot students. They were that specific. This is the antithesis of what you normally get of, I can't believe it. I know this guy. I'm a neighbor. He's the sweetest guy. This is the opposite. New York Times list. I know he's going to explode, a woman who knew Mr. Cruz said on the FBI's tip line on January 5th. Her big worry was that he might resort to, ready? Slipping, quote, into a school and just shooting the place up. 40 days later, he did that. Mr. Cruz, 19, himself called the authorities just after Thanksgiving, describing how he had been in a fight and was struggling with the death of his mother. The thing is, I lost my mother a couple of weeks ago, so like I am dealing with a bunch of things right now, he said in a childlike voice, sounding agitated and out of breath. The authorities have acknowledged mishandling numerous warning signs that Mr. Cruz was deeply troubled. There were tips to the FBI about disturbing social media posts. There were visits by social services to his home. There were dozens to 911 and the local authorities, some mentioning fears that he was capable of violence. More than once, Mr. Cruz was identified by those around him as someone capable of carrying out a school shooting. Which do you think failed us more in the 17 deaths? Authorities or gun laws?
For more from Dennis Prager, go to townhallreview.com. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for the podcast and never miss an episode of the Town Hall Review. Coming up.
If this decision goes the way that I think it should, it will send shockwaves through California. It really is the Achilles tendon of the California Democratic Party.
The Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis, in for Hugh Hewitt. A cluster of Democrats have compared the Russian attempts to influence the 2016 election to the invasion of Pearl Harbor and even 9/11. Salem host Mike Gallagher took this question to former assistant U.S. attorney and National Review columnist Andrew McCarthy.
Is Russian meddling in our election equivalent to 9/11 or Pearl Harbor? Now, that's what I'm hearing lately. We're getting some pretty prominent people, not dumb people, Karen Tumulty, others, another veteran journalist, Jonathan Alter, comparing this, you know, after seeing the Russian indictment, the Russian meddling attempts are being compared to these awful attacks that killed thousands of people on American soil. Do you see it that way, Andy McCarthy?
Oh, Mike, I think it's a combination of 9/11 and Pearl Harbor. And I think I'd throw in like the fall of the Roman Empire, too.
And the bubonic plague, you know?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's the end of the Republic.
I just think people get really, I mean, it's amazing what Trump does to people. I just think he's got this way of making them so crazy they can't think straight. But gotten to the point, Mike, where it really affects people's analytical. I mean, as you point out, you know, I wouldn't agree with Karen Tumulty and John Alter on much of anything politically, I suppose. But they're not unreasonable, irrational lunatics.
No.
And yet with these things that they're spelling out are lunatic comparisons. Russia has been meddling in American elections forever. I mean, there's nothing new about this. And in fact, the notable thing, I think, about Mueller's indictment of these 13 Russians and three Russian companies is that it's actually, I think, a fairly big retreat from the original collusion narrative, which was that Russia hacked the election, that they were involved in this hacking of the Democratic email accounts, and that Trump people were somehow complicit in that. And that was what led to this whole collusion narrative and ultimately the investigation. There's not a word of that in this indictment. And my sense of it has been that far from, you know, comparing it to something like Pearl Harbor, I think what you have here is a situation where a prosecutor has a big hole in his case, namely the need to prove that Russia actually meddled in the election. And I'm not, understand me now, I'm not saying that Russia didn't meddle in the election, but I have to look at this like a prosecutor, not an intelligence guy.
Right. And as a radio host who loves his country, I'm not happy and I'm not endorsing or supporting any country trying to meddle right. in our election. Nobody's saying that, but we're also not saying this is World War III. I mean, if the numbers are right, what, these 13 Russian trolls spent, I've seen two numbers now, $46,000 or $100,000 on Facebook and Instagram. $46,000, they spent like $800 in Michigan. Andy, this is not the stuff of which Armageddon is made.
No, even if it was, look, the high-end estimates of all they did that I've seen are in the range of about $5 million.
Mm-hmm.
That's a drop in the ocean of $1.6 billion in spending that happened in connection with this last
right.
election.
Right, and as so, long as we're all going to be up, and as long as we're on our high horses, I wonder if you saw the James Woolsey interview the other night with Laura Ingraham on Fox News, where they both shared a laugh over the ways we meddle in other countries' elections. And he giggled and said, well, only for a good cause. Ha, 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 ha. They were both laughing, but admitting, Woolsey admitting, well, yeah, we've meddled in Israel's, we've meddled in elections before. That's not a shock, is it?
Well, certainly not. I mean, look, Obama tried to get Netanyahu knocked out, right?
Correct.
Campaigned against him. And,
right.
And he campaigned against Brexit. And, you know, Bush wanted to remake the Middle East. And, you know, we got all kinds of things that we try to do.
Right, right. But nothing to see here. No, let's not talk right. about that. But now the Russians and Trump, now we got a party.
Yeah, but it's, you know, it's very foolish. As I wrote a column about this, and I argued in the column that because this is exactly the kind of activity that we get involved in. I'm not saying that we customarily do bank fraud and wire fraud and the other stuff that Mueller puts in his indictment, although, there's some things that go on that are pretty shady. But my point is, since it's our proud boast that it's part of what America is all about to promote our values throughout the world, I think it's a very dangerous road to go down to say that this kind of information promotion, to the extent it affects the politics and elections of other countries, is now an indictable felony.
Right,
Because it seems to me that that'd be the kind of thing that bite us more than it's going to bite the Russians.
Dianne Feinstein has been a senator from California for 26 years. Something shocking happened to the 84-year-old liberal this past week. She was unable to garner the support of her own Democratic Party in California. Pete Peterson is the dean of the Pepperdine University Graduate School of Public Policy. He explained how this happened on the Hugh Hewitt Show.
Now, give me your two cents on what it means. People will wake up today and they will find that the California Democratic Party
did not endorse Dianne Feinstein for re-election, instead endorsed the hyper-liberal Kevin DeLeon. What did you make of that?
Well, it's what I see as being what I call the burnification of the California Democratic Party that started back in 2016. And there are a lot of Bernie bros out here, especially in Southern California, as you might know, Hugh, that really thought that they were slighted back in 2016. And I believe they're taking over the California Democratic Party.
Do you think that Dianne Feinstein can actually lose that primary?
Well, certainly the polls show that she's well ahead. The latest PPIC poll shows her at least 25 or 30 points ahead. But the energy, as you say, that was demonstrated over the weekend at the at their state convention certainly is behind DeLeon. So it should be interesting to see what happens in these next few months.
There's also a case being argued today at the Supreme Court, Dean Peterson, about public employee unions, that if it goes the way we expect, we'll defund public employee unions. What will the impact be in the Golden State?
It will be huge, Hugh. I mean, as someone who didn't grow up out here, I grew up in the Northeast. I really, when I came out here about 15 years ago, I didn't understand the power, particularly of the public sector unions here in politics. They are the foundation of the California Democratic Party. And if this decision goes the way that I think it should, it will send shockwaves through California. It really is the Achilles tendon of the California Democratic Party.
The case is Janus versus AFSCME. And I think of the California Teachers Association. Everybody loves their teachers, right, but nobody likes the CTA. If the CTA right can't automatically dun every teacher in California for a couple of dozen bucks every month, they're crippled.
They really are, Hugh, and it affects policy, as you point out, with education and the ability for charters to start up. That would significantly be impacted, but also just more broadly, the amount of money that is taken out of paychecks of regular workers here who are unionized and go directly into the coffers of the Democratic Party really is a significant part of their annual budget. So it would have a huge impact here politically.
For the entire interview with Pete Peterson, go to townhallreview.com. Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's a unique graduate program impacting policy decisions today, preparing public leaders for tomorrow. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up, Larry Elder.
I don't understand people urging that we ban an entire category of firearms, if not firearms altogether, because one may be used in a crime. But the same logic does not apply to illegal aliens.
The Town Hall Review continues in just a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis in for Hugh Hewitt. With every school shooting, there is a reflexive challenge to the Second Amendment. Rarely does it gather much steam. Emotions are high at first, and then calm prevails. But the latest is particularly strong as the far left has poured millions into this anti-gun campaign, including an upcoming march in the nation's capital. Salem host Larry Elder looks at the latest.
People on the left have referred to President Trump many, many times as a dictator, as a tyrant, likened him to Adolf Hitler. If you're serious, if you believe that, why in the world would you want any kind of infringement at all on the very mechanism designed to make sure that this would-be Hitler cannot take control? Why would you do that? Are you serious? If you're serious, would you simultaneously want to make sure that Americans cannot defend themselves against this Hitler? Unless you're really not serious and you're just saying it for political purposes. I'm not sure which is more disgusting, whether you believe it or whether you don't believe it. But if you do, I really do not understand why in the world you want to curtail the Second Amendment, which is designed to prevent the very thing from happening that you claim has happened, which is that the American people have elected a dictator. What part of shall not be infringed don't you understand? What part of the Militia Act have you not read that says all males ages 17 to 45, able-bodied, are part of the militia? And you keep asking why it is a 19-year-old can get a firearm? That's why. I don't understand people urging that we ban an entire category of firearms, if not firearms altogether, because one may be used in a crime or some may be used in a crime, but the same logic does not apply to illegal aliens, several of whom have committed violent crimes, you know. You have some people on the left urging laws so that people could be committed against their will involuntarily, even when they're not judged by a court to be of danger to himself or to others or herself or to others. When it was the ACLU that in the 70s led the charge to put pressure on mental hospitals to release patients that they believed were involuntarily committed. Bruce Ennis, the head of the New York chapter of the ACLU, said this in 1974, quote, "My personal goal is either to abolish involuntary commitment or to set up so many procedural roadblocks and hurdles that it will be difficult, if not impossible, for the state to commit people against their will," close quote. Now, I'm not saying he's wrong. What I'm saying is this is on the left. And people on the left are now saying that we want laws so that people could be involuntarily committed, when it was people on the left that wanted those laws to go away. Are you kidding me? We are investigating Trump for collusion because we believe that the Russians meddled in our election. But the very same people who are making this claim have no interest whatsoever in photo voter ID to make sure that our election have voter integrity. So let's have all this time and spend all this money investigating Russian meddling, but let's not spend any money making sure that people who show up at the voting booth are in fact the people who say they are and that they're legally eligible to vote. I'm a little confused. Tom Friedman is a columnist with the New York Times. He's one of many who says that the Republicans have sold their soul to the NRA. Implication, all you have to do is write somebody a check and they'll do what you tell them. Never mind, study after study after study shows it's not true. Sold their soul to the NRA.
Well, it's one party has completely sold their soul to them. That's what the Republican Party has done. And there's only one way to defeat them. I go back to where I started. Don't tweet about it. Don't Facebook post about it. Register to vote, run for office, help someone run for office, fund for someone running for office, help someone get to the voting booth. You got to take power. They have power. They're not winning in the chat room. They're winning in the cloakroom, okay? They're not on Facebook. They're in people's face. Get out of Facebook. Get in their face in the only way that counts, and that's by winning elections and electing people for sane gun law.
And here is a Democratic Florida representative urging a complete ban on the AR-15.
Right now, Wolf, the real issue is how do we get these AR-15s out of the hand of these kids? And how do we get the AR-15s off the streets? And my solution at this particular moment, while we're discussing exactly what needs to be done, is to issue a moratorium on the sales of AR-15s.
I think long guns of all types are used in about 3% of gun crimes. I have no idea what percentage of these long arms are AR-15s. I suspect probably about 1%. What about the other 99%? We ban this one because it's a semi-automatic weapon that's a long gun. Why shouldn't we ban other long guns that are semi-automatic weapons? And why should they be restricted just to long guns? Why not other semi-automatic weapons that are handguns? That's their objective. Ultimately, their objective is a complete and total ban, a repeal of the Second Amendment.
Coming up.
We support free association, but the current system that compels all employees to pay something to a union, that's not free.
Unions face a tough day in court when the Town Hall Review returns in a moment. Welcome back to Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis. Early in the week, the Supreme Court took on a case that the Democrats are deeply concerned about. For decades now, unions and taking money from workers, giving it to Democrats and other left-wing causes without consent. That has now been challenged in the courts. The case is Janus versus AFSCME, which is the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. Now it's before the Supreme Court, where oral arguments were heard on Monday. Hugh Hewitt spoke with David Dewhurst, Chief Litigation Counsel for the Freedom Foundation.
I'm feeling very confident about this decision because of the 4-4 split. And Friedrichs, how are you feeling?
I feel pretty good about it. You know, there's the new justice, Justice Gorsuch, and he doesn't really have a long history of labor law cases to look at. When he was at the 10th Circuit, there's not really a good labor law body of work. But as you'll remember, he did decide the Hobby Lobby case when it was at the 10th Circuit. Another case that had to do with compelled speech, compelled funding for causes and ideas that you don't agree with. And I think he came down the right way in that case. So that provides some comfort on that.
Now, one of the reasons I like people to focus on Janice is the Michigan amicus brief, David, points out the collective bargaining with public employee unions helped cause multiple municipal bankruptcies in Detroit, Michigan, in Stockton, California, in San Bernardino, California, again and again. Self-dealing unions raise the cost of government so high that they bankrupt and thus cripple essential city services all to get their slice of the pie before the taxpayers get the services they've paid for. That's why I think it's important as a matter of public policy that you and your allied forces win this, because government's collapsing under the cost of unions.
I think that's absolutely right. I mean, you look at different places in the Rust Belt. You look at the state of Illinois, which is a mess because of this. You know, to some extent, the West Coast is a little more insulated. California may be accepted just because of the unique business climate and situation out there. So they're somewhat insulated from the bad public policy decisions that they make. But this is a problem everywhere. And indeed, this is the fundamental problem with public sector unionism in the first place. You know, while we support the right of workers to freely associate, this is A, first, not free association, but two, unionizing in the public sector presents some unique problems. Even Franklin Roosevelt recognized that in the 1930s. He thought it was beyond the pale to even consider unionizing public employees because, unlike a business person against whom employees are bargaining, this time you're bargaining against the public fist, against taxpayers, and that puts public servants in a really unique position. It creates a lot of perverse incentives, and that's exactly what we've seen in these states that have been so negatively affected by.
So assume for a moment you win, and that Janice is told he doesn't have to make his $45 a month payment to AFSCME. What happens in the aftermath of that? How quickly does injunctive relief against mandatory deduction follow?
Well, that's really where the Freedom Foundation is kind of leading the way nationally. In 2014, there was a similar case called Harris versus Quinn that applied to partial public employees. So not teachers, not state civil service employees, but Medicaid-funded home health care providers. It basically was a decision that made those employees nationwide right to work. So we immediately went about the work of trying to inform those folks along the West Coast about their rights. When we were able to communicate with them, they went through the process. They opted out of their unions. Many of them didn't know they were in a union in the first place. And we imagine that the process will look kind of the same in the public sector, with teachers, with state civil service employees, local public employees. But what we've seen is a broad effort on the part of union-backed legislatures along the West Coast to preempt Janus, to get ready for it. So, for instance, in the state of Washington, the legislature this term has already passed a measure making public employee information inaccessible through the Public Records Act. So you no longer have a right to know who your public employees are. Of course, that was the main tool that we and other groups used to contact employees, tell them about their rights. Secondly, they've enacted things like opt-out schemes, where as soon as someone becomes a public employee or as a matter of default, they're considered full-fledged union members, and they have to go through the opt-out process themselves, which is very cumbersome and sometimes very restrictive. They have mandatory meetings on state time where they're actually made to endure this union indoctrination, and that's pretty uniform up and down the West Coast. So they've been getting ready for this, and so we have lawsuits challenging many of these measures already up and down the West Coast, but these are the tactics that unions are going to use because the bottom line for them is their bottom line. They don't necessarily care about advancing their workers' interests. They care about maintaining their revenue stream.
But if the court is clear enough, there won't be a circuit in the country that can uphold mandatory deduction of union dues for any purpose at all, if the court is clear enough. And I happen to know that some of the justices listen to this program as they drive into the court. Their language has to be completely crystal clear. If they've got five votes, they can't muss it around. They can't remand it. They just have to say, stop imposing your views on individuals who do not share them.
Yeah. And that's one of the things we specifically asked for in one of our amicus briefs. Was to phrase the holding in a way that says you can only deduct union dues from an employee's wages after their prior affirmative consent. And if they crafted an opinion like that, then that would take away some of the tactics that are being employed across the country in advance of Janus. It would take away some of the tactics that have been employed against other types of publicly funded employees, like these in-home health care providers we've worked with for the last several years.
And by the way, prior affirmative consent, there isn't a conservative or an originalist out there who objects to that. If you can get someone's prior affirmative consent and make it easy for them to change their minds, maybe it gets tight in their household. Maybe someone loses a job and they want their $50 a month back. But a lot of these union employees will step up and say, yeah, I'm a Democrat. I want my Democrat union to do Democrat funding of campaigns, and I want to be in the union. Sure. That's okay with me and you, right?
Sure, absolutely. Again, we support free association, but the current system that compels all employees to pay something to a union, that's not free. And so we encourage free association and free speech. This isn't that.
And so at the end of the day, do you expect this to be June before we see the end of this, or do we think it's a quick decision, given that it was teed up, it's been teed up for 4 years to have this decision come down? I'm assuming, again, that Justice Gorsuch will vote as Justice Scalia would have voted.
Yeah, you know, again, looking back over the last several years, since 2012, the court itself has been questioning this practice pretty sharply. In 2014, they questioned it almost, they came very close to overturning the precedent from the 1970s that allows these types of compelled unionism arrangements. So, yes, we're expecting Justice Gorsuch will probably come down with the majority that has ruled in those previous cases, and we're feeling pretty confident about it. If they come down with a ruling that addresses, you know, prior affirmative consent, then we could be talking about an opinion that has immediate impacts across the country. If they don't, and if they simply say that you can't force public employees to pay these so-called agency fees, then we have to think of Janus less like the finish line and more like the starter's pistol for workers' rights.
Our program is coming to you today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy, where they are preparing leaders for the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Coming up.
The younger you are, the more likely you are to be on the left because you don't have wisdom at 15.
Dennis Prager with the final segment of the Town Hall Review in a moment. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Mark Davis, filling in this week for Hugh Hewitt. There are two major events planned in the wake of the shooting in Florida. We have the National School Walkout on March 14th and the March for Our Lives on the 24th. Both of these are planned and financed by adults with a left-wing anti-gun agenda. But kids, particularly survivors of the recent shooting, are being used as props. So regardless, how much stock should we put in the opinions of kids? If you're watching a CNN town hall or something like it, the indication is that they want you to hang on every word. But here's Dennis Prager.
Bill Press, man of the left, writes a piece in The Hill. Let's let high school students direct policy on guns. And this is part of the belief on the left that we have so much to learn from children. And there's a reason that they believe that. It's because they are children in their own wisdom quotient. They're amazing, the guys on the left. Put high school students in charge. They know best. This is another feature of our friends on the left. They believe that there is a lot to be learned from children. Now, there's a lot to be learned from having children. You learn a lot about yourself and about life. But if indeed high school students should be in charge of gun policy, then we should obviously have them vote. And this is now catching on. I told you the Harvard professor, a very well-known one, Lawrence Tribe, has suggested that the voting age be lowered to 16. And you know my theory is the reason the left wants the vote to go down, there are only two reasons. One is the younger you are, the more likely you are to be on the left because you don't have wisdom at 15, just the way it is. Some kids do, especially kids who've grown up in a religious home because they've studied the Bible, and the Bible has more wisdom than the New York Times or CNN. Just Triple G asks, does the left value, what did you ask? Learning from youth rather than from history. If you put the question to them, they would say no, that you would learn from both. But certainly if you were to say, would you rather learn from high school kids or from the Bible, they would laugh so hard they might be hospitalized for hyper laughter. It would injure their stomach muscles. So one reason they want to high school kids in charge is, or to get the vote, certainly, is to have more Democrats. But the other reason is they have so little wisdom, they really do believe that 15-year-olds can guide them.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review. Catch up on old episodes at our website, townhallreview.com. Start at our site, subscribe to our Apple podcast via Stitcher, SoundCloud, Google Play. And special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producers Charlie Richards, David Posian, Chanda Chisala, and Dwayne Patterson. Our program's been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Do join us next week for another edition of Town Hall Review, the week in review program from a perspective you can trust.
Three-star General Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.